found a refuge in the monastery of his brethren, and their theological lessons were repaid with the gift a spacious and wealthy domain. The name and doctrine of this venerable school were propagated among the Greeks and Syrians, and their zeal is expressed by Macarius, Patriarch of Antioch, who declared before the Synod of Constantinople that sooner than subscribe the two wills of Christ, he would submit to be hewn piecemeal and cast into the sea. A similar, more or less cruel, mode of persecution soon converted the unresisting subjects of the plain, while the glorious title of Mardaites, or rebels, was bravely maintained by the hardy natives of Mount Labanus. John Maron, one of the most learned and popular of the monks, assumed the character of Patriarch of Antioch. His nephew, Abraham, at the head of the Maronites, defended their civil and religious freedom against the tyrants of the East. The son of the Orthodox Constantine pursued with pious hatred a people of soldiers who might have stood the bulwark of his empire against the common foes of Christ and of Rome. An army of Greeks invaded Syria. The monastery of St. Maron was destroyed with fire. The bravest chieftains were betrayed and murdered, and 12,000 of their followers were transplanted to the distant frontiers of Armenia and Thrace. Yet the humble nation of the Maronites had survived the empire of Constantinople, and they still enjoy, under their Turkish masters, a free religion and a mitigated servitude. Their domestic governors are chosen among the ancient nobility. The patriarch, in his monastery of Canobin, still fancies himself on the throne of Antioch. 9 bishops compose his synod, and 150 priests, who retain the liberty of marriage, are entrusted with the care of 100,000 souls. Their country extends from the ridge of Mount Libanus to the shores of Tripoli, and the gradual descent affords, in a narrow space, each variety of soil and climate, from the holy cedars, erect under the weight of snow, to the vine, the mulberry, and the olive trees of the fruitful valley. In the 12th century, the Maronites, abjuring the monothelite era, were reconciled to the Latin churches of Antioch and Rome, and the same alliance has been frequently renewed by the ambition of the popes and the distress of the Syrians. But it may reasonably be questioned whether their union has ever been perfect or sincere, and the learned Maronites of the College of Rome have vainly labored to absolve their ancestors from the guilt of heresy and schism. Since the age of Constantine, the Armenians had signalized their attachment to the religion and empire of the Christians. The disorders of their country and their ignorance of the Greek tongue prevented their clergy from assisting at the Synod of Chalcedon, and they floated 84 years in a state of indifference or suspense, till their vacant faith was finally occupied by the missionaries of Julian of Halicarnassus, who in Egypt, their common exile, had been vanquished by the arguments or the influence of his rival Severus, the Monophysite Patriarch of Antioch. The Armenians alone are the pure disciples of Eutyches, an unfortunate parent who has been renounced by the greater part of his spiritual progeny. They alone persevere in the opinion that the manhood of Christ was created, or existed without creation, of a divine and incorruptible substance. Their adversaries reproach them with the adoration of a phantom, and they retort the accusation by deriding or execrating the blasphemy of the Jacobites, who impute to the Godhead the vile infirmities of the flesh, even the natural effects of nutrition and digestion. The religion of Armenia could not derive much glory from the learning or the power of its inhabitants. The royalty expired with the origin of their schism, and their Christian kings, who arose and fell in the 13th century on the confines of Cilicia, were the clients of the Latins and the vassals of the Turkish Sultan of Iconium. The helpless nation has seldom been permitted to enjoy the tranquility of servitude. From the earliest period to the present hour, Armenia has been the theater of perpetual war. The lands between Tauris and Erivan were dispeopled by the cruel policy of the Sophists, and myriads of Christian families were transplanted to perish or to propagate in the distant provinces of Persia. Under the rod of oppression, the zeal of the Armenians is fervent and intrepid. They have often preferred the crown of martyrdom to the white turban of Mohammed. They devoutly hate the error and idolatry of the Greeks, and their transient union with the Latins is not less devoid of truth than the 1,000 bishops whom their patriarch offered at the feet of the Roman pontiff. The Catholic or patriarch of the Armenians resides in the monastery of Ekmiasin, 3 leagues from Erivan. 47 archbishops, each of whom may claim the obedience of 4 or 5 suffragans, are consecrated by his hand, but the far greater part are only titular prelates, who dignify with their presence and service the simplicity of his court. As soon as they have performed the liturgy, they cultivate the garden, and our bishops will hear with surprise that the austerity of their life increases in just proportion to the elevation of their rank. In the 80,000 towns or villages of his spiritual empire, the patriarch receives a small and voluntary tax from each person above the age of 15. But the annual amount of 600,000 crowns is insufficient to supply the incessant demands of charity and tribute. Since the beginning of the last century, the Armenians have obtained a large and lucrative share of the commerce of the East. In their return from Europe, the caravan usually halts in the neighborhood of Erivan. The altars are enriched with the fruits of their patient industry, and the faith of Eutyches is preached in their recent congregations of Barbary and Poland. In the rest of the Roman Empire, the despotism of the prince might eradicate or silence the sectaries of an obnoxious creed. But the stubborn temper of the Egyptians maintained their opposition to the Synod of Chalcedon, and the policy of Justinian condescended to expect and to seize the opportunity of discord. The Monophysite Church of Alexandria was torn by the disputes of the corruptibles and incorruptibles, and on the death of the patriarch, the two factions upheld their respective candidates. Gaian was the disciple of Julian. Theodosius had been the pupil of Severus. The claims of the former were supported by the consent of the monks and senators, the city and the province. The latter depended on the priority of his ordination, the favor of the Empress Theodora, and the arms of the eunuch Narses, which might have been used in more honorable warfare. The exile of the popular candidate to Carthage and Sardinia inflamed the ferment of Alexandria, and after a schism of 170 years, the Gaianites still revered the memory and doctrine of their founder. The strength of numbers and of discipline was tried in a desperate and bloody conflict. The streets were filled with the dead bodies of citizens and soldiers. The pious women, ascending the roofs of their houses, showered down every sharp or ponderous utensil on the heads of the enemy. Then the final victory of Narses was owing to the flames with which he wasted the third capital of the Roman world. But the lieutenant of Justinian had not conquered in the cause of a heretic. Theodosius himself was speedily, though gently, removed, and Paul of Tanis, an orthodox monk, was raised to the throne of Athanasius. The powers of government were strained in his support. He might appoint or displace the dukes and tribunes of Egypt. The allowance of bread, which Diocletian had granted, was suppressed. The churches were shut, and a nation of schismatics was deprived at once of their spiritual and carnal food. In his turn, the tyrant was excommunicated by the zeal and revenge of the people, and none except his servile Melchites would salute him as a man, a Christian, or a bishop. Yet such is the blindness of ambition that when Paul was expelled on a charge of murder, he solicited, with a bribe of 700 pounds of gold, his restoration to the same station of hatred and ignominy. His successor, Apollinaris, entered the hostile city in military array, alike qualified for prayer or for battle. His troops, under arms, were distributed through the streets. The gates of the cathedral were guarded, and a chosen band was stationed in the choir to defend the person of their chief. He stood erect on his throne, and throwing aside the upper garment of a warrior, suddenly appeared before the eyes of the multitude in the robes of Patriarch of Alexandria. Astonishment held them mute, but no sooner had Apollinaris begun to read the tome of St. Leo than a volley of curses and invectives and stones assaulted the odious minister of the emperor and the synod. A charge was instantly sounded by the successor of the apostles. The soldiers waded to their knees in blood, and 200,000 Christians are said to have fallen by the sword. An incredible account, even if it be extended from the slaughter of a day to the 18 years of the reign of Apollinaris. Two succeeding patriarchs, Eulogius and John, labored in the conversion of heretics with arms and arguments more worthy of their evangelical profession. The theological knowledge of Eulogius was displayed in many a volume, which magnified the errors of Eutyches and Severus, and attempted to reconcile the ambiguous language of St. Cyril with the orthodox creed of Pope Leo and the fathers of Chalcedon. The bounteous alms of John the Elii Mercenary were dictated by superstition, or benevolence, or policy. 7,500 poor were maintained at his expense. On his accession he found 8,000 pounds of gold and the treasury of the church. He collected 10,000 from the liberality of the faithful, yet the primate could boast in his testament that he left behind him no more than the third part of the smallest of the silver coins. The churches of Alexandria were delivered to the Catholics. The religion of the Monophysites was proscribed in Egypt, and a law was revived which excluded the natives from the honors and emoluments of the state. A more important conquest still remained, of the patriarch, the oracle, and leader of the Egyptian church. Theodosius had resisted the threats and promises of Justinian with the spirit of an apostle or an enthusiast. Such, replied the patriarch, were the offers of the tempter when he showed the kingdoms of the earth, but my soul is far dearer to me than life or dominion. The churches are in the hands of a prince who can kill the body, but my conscience is my own, and in exile, poverty, or chains, I will steadfastly adhere to the faith of my holy predecessors, Athanasius, Cyril, and Dioscorus. Anathema to the tome of Leo and the synod of Chalcedon. Anathema to all who embrace their creed. Anathema to them now and forevermore. Naked came I out of my mother's womb. Naked shall I descend into the grave. Let those who love God follow me and seek their salvation. After comforting his brethren, he embarked for Constantinople and sustained in 6 successive interviews the almost irresistible weight of the royal presence. His opinions were favorably entertained in the palace and the city. The influence of Theodora assured him a safe conduct and honorable dismission. And he ended his days, though not on the throne, yet in the bosom of his native country. On the news of his death, Apollinaris indecently feasted the nobles and the clergy, but his joy was checked by the intelligence of a new election, and while he enjoyed the wealth of Alexandria, his rivals reigned in the monasteries of Thebais, and were maintained by the voluntary oblations of the people. A perpetual succession of patriarchs arose from the ashes of Theodosius, and the Monophysite churches of Syria and Egypt were united by the name of Jacobites and the communion of the faithful. But the same faith which has been confined to a narrow sect of the Syrians was diffused over the mass of the Egyptian or Coptic nation, who almost unanimously rejected the decrees of the Synod of Chalcedon. 1,000 years were now elapsed since Egypt had ceased to be a kingdom, since the conquerors of Asia and Europe had trampled on the ready necks of a people whose ancient wisdom and power ascend beyond the records of history. The conflict of zeal and persecution rekindled some sparks of their national spirit. They abjured, with a foreign heresy, the manners and language of the Greeks. Every Melkite in their eyes was a stranger. Every Jacobite, a citizen, the alliance of marriage, the offices of humanity, were condemned as a deadly sin. The natives renounced all allegiance to the emperor, and his orders at a distance from Alexandria were obeyed only under the pressure of military force. A generous effort might have redeemed the religion and liberty of Egypt, and her 600 monasteries might have poured forth their myriads of holy warriors, for whom death should have no terrors, since life had no comfort or delight. But experience has proved the distinction of active and passive courage. The fanatic who endures without a groan the torture of the rack or the stake, who would tremble and fly before the face of an armed enemy. The pusillanimous temper of the Egyptians could only hope for a change of masters. The arms of Chosroes depopulated the land, yet under his reign the Jacobites enjoyed a short and precarious respite. The victory of Heraclius renewed and aggravated the persecution, and the patriarch again escaped from Alexandria to the desert. In his flight, Benjamin was encouraged by a voice which bade him expect, at the end of 10 years, the aid of a foreign nation, marked, like the Egyptians themselves, with the ancient rite of circumcision. The character of these deliverers and the nature of the deliverance will be hereafter explained, and I shall step over the interval of 11 centuries to observe the present misery of the Jacobites of Egypt. The popular city of Cairo affords a residence, or rather a shelter, for their indigent patriarch, and a remnant of 10 bishops. 40 monasteries have survived the inroads of the Arabs, and the progress of servitude and apostasy has reduced the Coptic nation to the despicable number of 25,000 or 30,000 families, a race of illiterate beggars whose only consolation is derived from the superior wretchedness of the Greek patriarch and his diminutive congregation. The Coptic patriarch, a rebel to the Caesars or a slave to the caliphs, still gloried in the filial obedience of the kings of Nubia and Ethiopia. He repaid their homage by magnifying their greatness, and it was boldly asserted that they could bring into the field 100,000 horse with an equal number of camels, that their hand could pour out or restrain the waters of the Nile, and the peace and plenty of Egypt was obtained, even in this world, by the intercession of the patriarch. In exile at Constantinople, Theodosius recommended to his patroness the conversion of the black nations of Nubia from the Tropic of Cancer to the confines of Abyssinia. Her design was suspected and emulated by the more orthodox emperor. The rival missionaries, a Melkite and a Jacobite, embarked at the same time. But the empress, from a motive of love or fear, was more effectually obeyed, and the Catholic priest was detained by the president of Thebais, while the king of Nubia and his court were hastily baptized in the faith of Dioscorus. The tardy envoy of Justinian was received and dismissed with honor, but when he accused the heresy and treason of the Egyptians, the Negro convert was instructed to reply that he would never abandon his brethren, the true believers, to the persecuting ministers of the Synod of Chalcedon. During several ages, the bishops of Nubia were named and consecrated by the Jacobite Patriarch of Alexandria. As late as the 12th century, Christianity prevailed, and some rites, some ruins, are still visible in the savage towns of Sana'a and Dongola. But the Nubians at length executed their threats of returning to the worship of idols. The climate required the indulgence of polygamy, and they have finally preferred the triumph of the Quran to the abasement of the cross. A metaphysical religion may appear too refined for the capacity of the Negro race, yet a black or a parrot might be taught to repeat the words of the Chalcedonian or Monophysite creed. Christianity was more deeply rooted in the Abyssinian Empire, and although the correspondence has been sometimes interrupted above 70 or 100 years, the Mother Church of Alexandria retains her colony in a state of perpetual pupillage. 7 bishops once composed the Ethiopic Synod. Had their number amounted to 10, they might have elected an independent primate, and one of their kings was ambitious of promoting his brother to the ecclesiastical throne. But the event was foreseen, the increase was denied, the episcopal office has been gradually confined to the Abuna, the head and author of the Abyssinian priesthood. The patriarch supplies each vacancy with an Egyptian monk, and the character of a stranger appears more venerable in the eyes of the people, less dangerous in those of the monarch. In the 6th century, when the schism of Egypt was confirmed, the rival chiefs, with their patrons, Justinian and Theodora, strove to outstrip each other in the conquest of a remote and independent province. The industry of the empress was again victorious, and the pious Theodora has established in that sequestered church the faith and discipline of the Jacobites. Encompassed on all sides by the enemies of their religion, the Ethiopians slept near 1,000 years, forgetful of the world by whom they were forgotten. They were awakened by the Portuguese, who, turning the southern promontory of Africa, appeared in India and the Red Sea, as if they had descended through the air from a distant planet. In the first moments of their interview, the subjects of Rome and Alexandria observed the resemblance, rather than the difference, of their faith, and each nation expected the most important benefits from an alliance with their Christian brethren. In their lonely situation, the Ethiopians had almost relapsed into the savage life. Their vessels, which had traded to Ceylon, scarcely presumed to navigate the rivers of Africa. The ruins of Aksum were deserted. The nation was scattered in villages, and the emperor, a pompous name, was content, both in peace and war, with the immovable residence of a camp. Conscious of their own indigence, the Abyssinians had formed the rational project of importing the arts and ingenuity of Europe, and their ambassadors at Rome and Lisbon were instructed to solicit a colony of smiths, carpenters, tilers, masons, printers, surgeons, and physicians for the use of their country. But the public danger soon called for the instant and effectual aid of arms and soldiers to defend an unwarlike people from the barbarians who ravaged the inland country and the Turks and Arabs who advanced from the seacoast in more formidable array. Ethiopia was saved by 450 Portuguese, who displayed in the field the native valor of Europeans and the artificial power of the musket and cannon. In a moment of terror, the emperor had promised to reconcile himself and his subjects to the Catholic faith. A Latin patriarch represented the supremacy of the Pope. The empire, enlarged in a tenfold proportion, was supposed to contain more gold than the mines of America, and the wildest hopes of avarice and zeal were built on the willing submission of the Christians of Africa. But the vows which pain had extorted were forsworn on the return of health. The Abyssinians still adhered with unshaken constancy to the Monophysite faith. Their languid belief was inflamed by the exercise of dispute. They branded the Latins with the names of Arians and Nestorians, and imputed the adoration of 4 gods to those who separated the 2 natures of Christ. Fremona, a place of worship, or rather of exile, was assigned to the Jesuit missionaries. Their skill in the liberal and mechanic arts, their theological learning, and the decency of their manners, inspired a barren esteem. But they were not endowed with the gift of miracles. and they vainly solicited a reinforcement of European troops. The patience and dexterity of 40 years at length obtained a more favorable audience, and 2 emperors of Abyssinia were persuaded that Rome could ensure the temporal and everlasting happiness of her votaries. The first of these royal converts lost his crown and his life, and the rebel army was sanctified by the Abuna, who hurled an anathema at the apostate and absolved his subjects from their oath of fidelity. The fate of Zadingel was revenged by the courage and fortune of Susneus, who ascended the throne under the name of Siguid, and more vigorously prosecuted the pious enterprise of his kinsmen. After the amusement of some unequal combats between the Jesuits and his illiterate priests, the emperor declared himself a proselyte to the Synod of Chalcedon, presuming that his clergy and people would embrace without delay the religion of their prince. The liberty of choice was succeeded by a law which imposed, under pain of death, the belief of the 2 natures of Christ. The Abyssinians were enjoined to work and to play on the Sabbath, and Siguid, in the face of Europe and Africa, renounced his connection with the Alexandrian Church. A Jesuit, Afonso Mendez, the Catholic Patriarch of Ethiopia, accepted in the name of Urban VIII the homage and abjuration of the penitent. "I confess," said the emperor on his knees, "I confess that the Pope is the vicar of Christ, the successor of St. Peter, and the sovereign of the world. To him I swear true obedience, and at his feet I offer my person and kingdom." A similar oath was repeated by his son, his brother, the clergy, the nobles, and even the ladies of the court. The Latin patriarch was invested with honors and wealth, and his missionaries erected their churches or citadels in the most convenient stations of the empire. The Jesuits themselves deplore the fatal indiscretion of their chief, who forgot the mildness of the gospel and the policy of his order to introduce with hasty violence the liturgy of Rome and the Inquisition of Portugal. He condemned the ancient practice of circumcision, which health, rather than superstition, had first invented in the climate of Ethiopia. A new baptism, a new ordination, was inflicted on the natives, and they trembled with horror when the most holy of the dead were torn from their graves, when the most illustrious of the living were excommunicated by foreign priest. In the defense of their religion and liberty, the Abyssinians rose in arms with desperate but unsuccessful zeal. 5 rebellions were extinguished in the blood of the insurgents. 2 Abunas were slain in battle. Whole legions were slaughtered in the field or suffocated in their caverns, and neither merit nor rank nor sex could save from an ignominious death the enemies of Rome. But the victorious monarch was finally subdued by the constancy of the nation, of his mother, of his son, and of his most faithful friends. Siguid listened to the voice of pity, of reason, perhaps of fear, and his edict of liberty of conscience instantly revealed the tyranny and weakness of the Jesuits. On the death of his father, Basilides expelled the Latin patriarch and restored to the wishes of the nation the faith and the discipline of Egypt. The Monophysite churches resounded with a song of triumph, that the sheep of Ethiopia were now delivered from the hyenas of the West, and the gates of that solitary realm were forever shut against the arts, the science, and the fanaticism of Europe. Chapter 48. succession, and characters of the Greek emperors of Constantinople from the time of Heraclius to the Latin conquest. I have now deduced from Trajan to Constantine, from Constantine to Heraclius, the regular series of the Roman emperors, and faithfully exposed the prosperous and adverse fortunes of their reigns. 5 centuries of the decline and fall of the empire have already elapsed, but a period of more than 800 years still separates me from the term of my labors, the taking of Constantinople by the Turks. Should I persevere in the same course, should I observe the same measure, a prolix and slender thread would be spun through many a volume, nor would the patient reader find an adequate reward of instruction or amusement. At every step, as we sink deeper in the decline and fall of the Eastern Empire, the annals of each succeeding reign would impose a more ungrateful and melancholy task. These annals must continue to repeat a tedious and uniform tale of weakness and misery. The natural connection of causes and events would be broken by frequent and hasty transitions, and a minute accumulation of circumstances must destroy the light and effect of those general pictures which compose the use and ornament of a remote history. From the time of Heraclius, the Byzantine theatre is contracted and darkened. The line of empire, which had been defined by the laws of Justinian and the arms of Belisarius, recedes on all sides from our view. The Roman name, the proper subject of our inquiries, is reduced to a narrow corner of Europe, to the lonely suburbs of Constantinople. And the fate of the Greek empire has been compared to that of the Rhine, which loses itself in the sands before its waters can mingle with the ocean. The scale of dominion is diminished to our view by the distance of time and place, nor is the loss of external splendor compensated by the nobler gifts of virtue and genius. In the last moments of her decay, Constantinople was doubtless more opulent and populous than Athens at her most flourishing era, when a scanty sum of 6,000 talents, or 1,200,000 pounds sterling, was possessed by 21,000 male citizens of an adult age. But each of these citizens was a freeman, who dared to assert the liberty of his thoughts, words, and actions, whose person and property were guarded by equal law, and who exercised his independent vote in the government of the Republic. Their numbers seemed to be multiplied by the strong and various discriminations of character. Under the shield of freedom, on the wings of emulation and vanity, each Athenian aspired to the level of the national dignity. From this commanding eminence, some chosen spirits soared beyond the reach of a vulgar eye. And the chances of superior merit in a great and populous kingdom, as they are proved by experience, would excuse the computation of imaginary millions. The territories of Athens, Sparta, and their allies do not exceed a moderate province of France or England, but after the trophies of Salamis and Plataea, they expand in our fancy to the gigantic size of Asia, which had been trampled under the feet of the victorious Greeks. But the subjects of the Byzantine Empire, who assume and dishonor the names both of Greeks and Romans, present a dead uniformity of abject vices which are neither softened by the weakness of humanity nor animated by the vigor of memorable crimes. The freeman of antiquity might repeat with generous enthusiasm the sentence of Homer, that on the first day of his servitude the captive is deprived of one half of his manly virtue. But the poet had only seen the effects of civil or domestic slavery, nor could he foretell that the second moiety of manhood must be annihilated by the spiritual despotism which shackles not only the actions, but even the thoughts of the prostrate votary. By this double yoke, the Greeks were oppressed under the successors of Heraclius. The tyrant, a law of eternal justice, was degraded by the vices of his subjects, and on the throne in the camp, in the schools, we search, perhaps with fruitless diligence, the names and characters that may deserve to be rescued from oblivion. Nor are the defects of the subject compensated by the skill and variety of the painters. Of a space of 800 years, the 4 first centuries are overspread with a cloud interrupted by some faint and broken rays of historic light. In the lives of the emperors, from Maurice to Alexius, Basil the Macedonian has alone been the theme of a separate work, and the absence or loss or imperfection of contemporary evidence must be poorly supplied by the doubtful authority of more recent compilers. The 4 last centuries are exempt from the reproach of penury, and with the Comnenian family, the historic muse of Constantinople again revives. But her apparel is gaudy. Her motions are without elegance or grace. A succession of priests or courtiers treads in each other's footsteps in the same path of servitude and superstition. Their views are narrow. Their judgment is feeble or corrupt. And we close the volume of copious barrenness, still ignorant of the causes of events, the characters of the actors, and the manners of the times which they celebrate or deplore. The observation which has been applied to a man may be extended to a whole people, that the energy of the sword is communicated to the pen, and it will be found by experience that the tone of history will rise or fall with the spirit of the age. From these considerations I should have abandoned without regret the Greek slaves and their servile historians, had I not reflected that the fate of the Byzantine monarchy is passively connected with the most splendid and important revolutions which have changed the state of the world. The space of the lost provinces was immediately replenished with new colonies and rising kingdoms. The active virtues of peace and war deserted from the vanquished to the victorious nations. And it is in their origin and conquests, in their religion and government, that we must explore the causes and effects of the decline and fall of the Eastern Empire. Nor will this scope of narrative, the riches and variety of these materials, be incompatible with the unity of design and composition. As in his daily prayers, the Musulman of Fez or Delhi still turns his face towards the temple of Mecca, the historian's eye shall be always fixed on the city of Constantinople. The excursive line may embrace the wilds of Arabia and Tartary, but the circle will be ultimately reduced to the decreasing limit of the Roman monarchy. On this principle I shall now establish the plan of the last 2 volumes of the present work. The 1st chapter will contain, in a regular series, the emperors who reigned at Constantinople during a period of 600 years, from the days of Heraclius to the Latin conquest, a rapid abstract which may be supported by a general appeal to the order and text of the original historians. In this introduction I shall confine myself to the revolutions of the throne, the succession of families, the personal characters of the Greek princes, the mode of their life and death, the maxims and influence of their domestic government, and the tendency of their reign to accelerate or suspend the downfall of the Eastern Empire. Such a chronological review will serve to illustrate the various argument of the subsequent chapters, and each circumstance of the eventful story of the barbarians will adapt itself in a proper place to the Byzantine annals. The internal state of the empire, and the dangerous heresy of the Paulicians, which shook the East and enlightened the West, will be the subject of 2 separate chapters. But these inquiries must be postponed till our further progress shall have opened the view of the world in the 9th and 10th centuries of the Christian era. After this foundation of Byzantine history, the following nations will pass before our eyes, and each will occupy the space to which it may be entitled by greatness or merit, or the degree of connection with the Roman world and the present age. The Franks. a general appellation which includes all the barbarians of France, Italy, and Germany, who were united by the sword and scepter of Charlemagne. The persecution of images and their votaries separated Rome and Italy from the Byzantine throne, and prepared the restoration of the Roman Empire in the West. The Arabs, or Saracens. Three ample chapters will be devoted to this curious and interesting object. In the first, after a picture of the country and its inhabitants, I shall investigate the character of Muhammad, the character, religion, and success of the Prophet. In the second, I shall lead the Arabs to the conquest of Syria, Egypt, and Africa, the provinces of the Roman Empire. Nor can I check their victorious career till they have overthrown the monarchies of Persia and Spain. In the third, I shall inquire how Constantinople and Europe were saved by the luxury and arts, the division and decay of the empire of the caliphs. A single chapter will include the Bulgarians, Hungarians, and Russians, who assaulted by sea or by land the provinces and the capital. But the last of these, so important in their present greatness, will excite some curiosity in their origin and infancy. The Normans, or rather the private adventurers of that warlike people who founded a powerful kingdom in Apulia and Sicily, shook the throne of Constantinople, displayed the trophies of chivalry, and almost realized the wonders of romance. The Latins, the subjects of the Pope, the nations of the West, who enlisted under the banner of the cross for the recovery or relief of the Holy Sepulchre. The Greek emperors were terrified and preserved by the myriads of pilgrims who marched to Jerusalem with Godfrey of Bouillon and the peers of Christendom. The Second and Third Crusades trod in the footsteps of the First. Asia and Europe were mingled in a sacred war of 200 years, and the Christian powers were bravely resisted and finally expelled by Saladin and the Mamelukes of Egypt. In these memorable crusades, a fleet and army of French and Venetians were diverted from Syria to the Thracian Bosphorus. They assaulted the capital. They subverted the Greek monarchy, and a dynasty of Latin princes was seated near 80 years on the throne of Constantine. The Greeks themselves, during this period of captivity and exile, must be considered as a foreign nation, the enemies and again the sovereigns of Constantinople. Misfortune had rekindled a spark of national virtue, and the imperial series may be continued with some dignity from their restoration to the Turkish conquest. The Mughals and Tartars. By the arms of Genghis and his descendants, the globe was shaken from China to Poland and Greece. The sultans were overthrown, the caliphs fell, and the Caesars trembled on their throne. The victories of Tamerlane suspended above 50 years the final ruin of the Byzantine Empire. I have already noticed the first appearance of the Turks, and the names of the fathers of Seljuk and Othman discriminate the two successive dynasties of the nation which emerged in the 11th century from the Scythian wilderness. The former established a splendid and potent kingdom from the banks of the Oxus to Antioch and Nice, and the First Crusade was provoked by the violation of Jerusalem and the danger of Constantinople. From a humble origin the Ottomans arose, the scourge and terror of Christendom. Constantinople was besieged and taken by Mahomet II, and his triumph annihilates the remnant, the image, the title of the Roman Empire in the East. The schism of the Greeks will be connected with their last calamities and the restoration of learning in the Western world. I shall return from the captivity of the new to the ruins of ancient Rome, and the venerable name, the interesting theme, will shed a ray of glory on the conclusion of my labors. The Emperor Heraclius had punished a tyrant and ascended his throne, and the memory of his reign is perpetuated by the transient conquest and irreparable loss of the eastern provinces. After the death of Eudokia, his first wife, he disobeyed the patriarch and violated the laws by his second marriage with his niece, Martina, and the superstition of the Greeks beheld the judgment of heaven in the diseases of the father and the deformity of his offspring. But the opinion of an illegitimate birth is sufficient to distract the choice and loosen the obedience of the people. The ambition of Martina was quickened by maternal love, and perhaps by the envy of a stepmother, and the aged husband was too feeble to withstand the arts of conjugal allurements. Constantine, his eldest son, enjoyed in a mature age the title of Augustus, but the weakness of his constitution required a colleague and a guardian, and he yielded with secret reluctance to the partition of the empire. The Senate was summoned to the palace to ratify or attest the association of Heracleonas, the son of Martina. The imposition of the diadem was consecrated by the prayer and blessing of the patriarch. The senators and patricians adored the majesty of the great emperor and the partners of his reign, and as soon as the doors were thrown open, they were hailed by the tumultuary but important voice of the soldiers. After an interval of 5 months, the pompous ceremonies which form the essence of the Byzantine state were celebrated in the cathedral and the hippodrome. The concord of the royal brothers was affectedly displayed by the younger leaning on the arm of the elder, and the name of Martina was mingled in the reluctant or venal acclamations of the people. Heraclius survived this association about 2 years. His last testimony declared his two sons the equal heirs of the Eastern Empire, and commanded them to honor his widow, Martina, as their mother and their sovereign. When Martina first appeared on the throne with the name and attributes of royalty, she was checked by firm, though respectful, opposition, and the dying embers of freedom were kindled by the breath of superstitious prejudice. "We reverence," exclaimed the voice of a citizen, "we reverence the mother of our princes, but to those princes alone our obedience is due, and Constantine, the elder emperor, is of an age to sustain in his own hands the weight of the scepter. Your sex is excluded by nature from the toils of government. How could you combat? How could you answer the barbarians who, with hostile or friendly intentions, may approach the royal city? May heaven avert from the Roman Republic this national disgrace, which would provoke the patience of the slaves of Persia." Martina descended from the throne with indignation, and sought a refuge in the female apartment of the palace. The reign of Constantine III lasted only 103 days. He expired in the 30th year of his age, and although his life had been a long malady, a belief was entertained that poison had been the means, and his cruel stepmother the author of his untimely fate. Martina reaped indeed the harvest of his death and assumed the government in the name of the surviving emperor, but the incestuous widow of Heraclius was universally abhorred. The jealousy of the people was awakened, and the two orphans whom Constantine had left became the objects of the public care. It was in vain that the son of Martina, who was no more than 15 years of age, was taught to declare himself the guardian of his nephews, one of whom he had presented at the baptismal font. It was in vain that he swore on the wood of the true cross to defend them against all their enemies. On his deathbed, the late emperor had dispatched a trusty servant to arm the troops and provinces of the east in the defense of his helpless children. The eloquence and liberality of Valentine had been successful, and from his camp at Chalcedon he boldly demanded the punishment of the assassins and the restoration of the lawful heir. The license of the soldiers, who devoured the grapes and drank the wine of their Asiatic vineyards, provoked the citizens of Constantinople against the domestic authors of their calamities, and the dome of St. Sophia re-echoed not with prayers and hymns, but with the clamours and imprecations of an enraged multitude. At their imperious command, Heraclionus appeared in the pulpit with the eldest of the royal orphans. Constans alone was saluted as emperor of the Romans, and the crown of gold, which had been taken from the tomb of Heraclius, was placed on his head with the solemn benediction of the patriarch. But in the tumult of joy and indignation, the church was pillaged. The sanctuary was polluted by a promiscuous crowd of Jews and barbarians, and the monothelite Pyrrhus, a creature of the empress, after dropping a protestation on the altar, escaped by prudent flight from the zeal of the Catholics. A more serious and bloody task was reserved for the Senate, who derived a temporary strength from the consent of the soldiers and people. The spirit of Roman freedom revived the ancient and awful examples of the judgment of tyrants, and the imperial culprits were deposed and condemned as the authors of the death of Constantine. But the severity of the conscript fathers was stained by the indiscriminate punishment of the innocent and the guilty. Martina and Heraclionus were sentenced to amputation, the former of her tongue, the latter of his nose. And after this cruel execution, they consumed the remainder of their days in exile and oblivion. The Greeks, who were capable of reflection, might find some consolation for their servitude by observing the abuse of power when it was lodged for a moment in the hands of an aristocracy. We shall imagine ourselves transported 500 years backwards to the age of the Antonines, if we listen to the oration which Constans II pronounced in the 12th year of his age before the Byzantine Senate. After returning his thanks for the just punishment of the assassins, who had intercepted the fairest hopes of his father's reign, quote, "By the divine providence," said the young emperor, "and by your righteous decree, Martina and her incestuous progeny have been cast headlong from the throne. Your majesty and wisdom have prevented the Roman state from degenerating into lawless tyranny. I therefore exhort and beseech you to stand forth as the counselors and judges of the common safety." The senators were gratified by the respectful address and liberal donative of their sovereign. But these servile Greeks were unworthy and regardless of freedom, and in his mind the lesson of an hour was quickly erased by the prejudices of the age and the habits of despotism. He retained only a jealous fear lest the Senate or people should one day invade the right of primogeniture and seat his brother Theodosius on an equal throne. By the imposition of holy orders, the grandson of Heraclius was disqualified for the purple. But this ceremony, which seemed to profane the sacraments of the church, was insufficient to appease the suspicions of the tyrant, and the death of the deacon Theodosius could alone expiate the crime of his royal birth. His murder was avenged by the imprecations of the people, and the assassin, in the fullness of power, was driven from his capital into voluntary and perpetual exile. Constans embarked for Greece, and, as if he meant to retort the abhorrence which he deserved, he is said, from the imperial galley, to have spit against the walls of his native city. After passing the winter at Athens, he sailed to Tarentum in Italy, visited Rome, and concluded a long pilgrimage of disgrace and sacrilegious rapine by fixing his residence at Syracuse. But if Constans could fly from his people, he could not fly from himself. The remorse of his conscience created a phantom who pursued him by land and sea, by day and by night. And the visionary Theodosius, presenting to his lips a cup of blood, said, or seemed to say, "Drink, brother, drink." A sure emblem of the aggravation of his guilt, since he had received from the hands of the deacon the mystic cup of the blood of Christ. odious to himself and to mankind, Constans perished by domestic, perhaps by episcopal, treason in the capital of Sicily. A servant who waited in the bath, after pouring warm water on his head, struck him violently with the vase. He fell, stunned by the blow and suffocated by the water, and his attendants, who wondered at the tedious delay, beheld with indifference the corpse of their lifeless emperor. The troops of Sicily invested with the purple an obscure youth, whose inevitable beauty eluded, and it might easily elude, the declining art of the painters and sculptors of the age. Constans had left in the Byzantine palace three sons, the eldest of whom had been clothed in his infancy with the purple. When the father summoned them to attend his person in Sicily, these precious hostages were detained by the Greeks, and a firm refusal informed him that they were the children of the state. The news of his murder was conveyed with almost supernatural speed from Syracuse to Constantinople, and Constantine, the eldest of his sons, inherited his throne without being the heir of the public hatred. His subjects contributed with zeal and alacrity to chastise the guilt and presumption of a province which had usurped the rights of the Senate and people. The young emperor sailed from the Hellespont with a powerful fleet, and the legions of Rome and Carthage were assembled under his standard in the harbour of Syracuse. The defeat of the Sicilian tyrant was easy, his punishment just, and his beauteous head was exposed in the hippodrome. But I cannot applaud the clemency of a prince who, among a crowd of victims, condemned the son of a patrician for deploring with some bitterness the execution of a virtuous father. The youth was castrated. He survived the operation, and the memory of this indecent cruelty is preserved by the elevation of Germanus to the rank of a patriarch and saint. After pouring this bloody libation on his father's tomb, Constantine returned to his capital, and the growth of his young beard during the Sicilian voyage was announced by the familiar surname of Pogonatus to the Grecian world. But his reign, like that of his predecessor, was stained with fraternal discord. On his two brothers, Heraclius and Tiberius, he had bestowed the title of Augustus, an empty title, for they continued to languish without trust or power in the solitude of the palace. At their secret instigation, the troops of the Anatolian theme or province approached the city on the Asiatic side, demanded for the royal brothers the partition or exercise of sovereignty, and supported their seditious claim by theological argument. They were Christians, they cried, and Orthodox Catholics, the sincere votaries of the holy and undivided Trinity. Since there are three equal persons in heaven, it is reasonable there should be three equal persons upon earth. The emperor invited these learned divines to a friendly conference in which they might propose their arguments to the Senate. They obeyed the summons, but the prospect of their bodies hanging on the gibbet in the suburb of Galata reconciled their companions to the unity of the reign of Constantine. He pardoned his brothers, and their names were still pronounced in the public acclamations, but on the repetition or suspicion of a similar offence, the obnoxious princes were deprived of their titles and noses, in the presence of the Catholic bishops who were assembled at Constantinople in the Sixth General Synod. In the close of his life, Pogonatus was anxious only to establish the right of primogeniture. The heir of his two sons, Justinian and Heraclius, was offered on the shrine of St. Peter as a symbol of their spiritual adoption by the Pope. But the elder was alone exalted to the rank of Augustus and the assurance of the empire. After the decease of his father, the inheritance of the Roman world devolved to Justinian II, and the name of a triumphant lawgiver was dishonored by the vices of a boy, who imitated his namesake only in the expensive luxury of building. His passions were strong, His understanding was feeble, and he was intoxicated with a foolish pride that his birth had given him the command of millions, of whom the smallest community would not have chosen him for their local magistrate. His favorite ministers were two beings the least susceptible of human sympathy, a eunuch and a monk. To the one he abandoned the palace, to the other the finances. The former corrected the emperor's mother with a scourge. The latter suspended the insolvent tributaries with their heads downwards over a slow and smoky fire. Since the days of Commodus and Caracalla, the cruelty of the Roman princes had most commonly been the effect of their fear. But Justinian, who possessed some vigor of character, enjoyed the sufferings and braved the revenge of his subjects about 10 years, till the measure was full of his crimes and of their patience. In a dark dungeon, Leontius, a general of reputation, had groaned above 3 years with some of the noblest and most deserving of the patricians. He was suddenly drawn forth to assume the government of Greece, and this promotion of an injured man was a mark of the contempt rather than of the confidence of his prince. As he was followed to the port by the kind offices of his friends, Leontius observed with a sigh that he was a victim adorned for sacrifice, and that inevitable death would pursue his footsteps. They ventured to reply that glory and empire might be the recompense of a generous resolution, that every order of men abhorred the reign of a monster, and that the hands of 200,000 patriots expected only the voice of a leader. The night was chosen for their deliverance, and in the first effort of the conspirators, the prefect was slain, and the prisons were forced open. The emissaries of Leontius proclaimed in every street, "Christians to Saint Sophia," and the seasonable text of the patriarch, "This is the day of the Lord," was the prelude of an inflammatory sermon. From the church the people adjourned to the hippodrome. Justinian, in whose cause not a sword had been drawn, was dragged before these tumultuary judges, and their clamors demanded the instant death of the tyrant. But Leontius, who was already clothed with the purple, cast an eye of pity on the prostrate son of his own benefactor and of so many emperors. The life of Justinian was spared. The amputation of his nose, perhaps of his tongue, was imperfectly performed. The happy flexibility of the Greek language could impose the name of Rhinometus, and the mutilated tyrant was banished to Chersonae in Crim Tartary, a lonely settlement where corn, wine, and oil were imported as foreign luxuries. On the edge of the Scythian wilderness, Justinian still cherished the pride of his birth and the hope of his restoration. After 3 years' exile, he received the pleasing intelligence that his injury was avenged by second revolution, and that Leontius in his turn had been dethroned and mutilated by the rebel Apsimar, who assumed the more respectable name of Tiberius. But the claim of lineal succession was still formidable to a plebeian usurper, and his jealousy was stimulated by the complaints and charges of the Chersonites, who beheld the vices of the tyrant in the spirit of the exile. With a band of followers, attached to his person by common hope or common despair, Justinian fled from the inhospitable shore to the horde of the Khazars, who pitched their tents between the Tanais and the Borysthenes. The Khan entertained with pity and respect the royal suppliant. Phanagoria, once an opulent city on the Asiatic side of the Lake Mutis, was assigned for his residence, and every Roman prejudice was stifled in his marriage with the sister of the barbarian, who seems, however, from the name of Theodora, to have received the sacrament of baptism. But the faithless Khazar was soon tempted by the gold of Constantinople, and had not the design been revealed by the conjugal love of Theodora, her husband must have been assassinated or betrayed into the power of his enemies. After strangling with his own hands the two emissaries of the Khan, Justinian sent back his wife to her brother, and embarked on the Black Sea in search of new and more faithful allies. His vessel was assaulted by a violent tempest, and one of his pious companions advised him to deserve the mercy of God by vow of general forgiveness, if he should be restored to the throne. "Of forgiveness?" replied the intrepid tyrant. "May I perish this instant. May the Almighty whelm me in the waves, if I consent to spare a single head of my enemies." He survived this impious menace, sailed into the mouth of the Danube, trusted his person in the royal village of the Bulgarians, and purchased the aid of Tebalus, a pagan conqueror, by the promise of his daughter and a fair partition of the treasures of the empire. The Bulgarian kingdom extended to the confines of Thrace, and the two princes besieged Constantinople at the head of 15,000 horse. Absamar was dismayed by the sudden and hostile apparition of his rival, whose head had been promised by the Khazar, and of whose evasion he was yet ignorant. After an absence of 10 years, the crimes of Justinian were faintly remembered, and the birth and misfortunes of their hereditary sovereign excited the pity of the multitude, ever discontented with the ruling powers. And by the active diligence of his adherents, he was introduced into the city and palace of Constantine. In rewarding his allies and recalling his wife, Justinian displayed some sense of honor and gratitude, and Tabalis retired, after sweeping away a heap of gold coin which he measured with his Scythian whip. But never was vow more religiously performed than the sacred oath of revenge which he had sworn amidst the storms of the Black Sea. The two usurpers, for I must reserve the name of tyrant for the conqueror, were dragged into the hippodrome, the one from his prison, the other from his palace. Before their execution, Leontius and Absamar were cast prostrate in chains beneath the throne of the emperor, and Justinian, planting a foot on each of their necks, contemplated above an hour the chariot race, while the inconstant people shouted in the words of the psalmist, "Thou shalt trample on the asp and basilisk, and on the lion and dragon shalt thou set thy foot." The universal defection which he had once experienced might provoke him to repeat the wish of Caligula that the Roman people had but one head. Yet I shall presume to observe that such a wish is unworthy of an ingenious tyrant, since his revenge and cruelty would have been extinguished by a single blow, instead of the slow variety of tortures which Justinian inflicted on the victims of his anger. His pleasures were inexhaustible. Neither private virtue nor public service could expiate the guilt of active or even passive obedience to an established government. And during the 6 years of his new reign, he considered the axe, the cord, and the rack as the only instruments of royalty. But his most implacable hatred was pointed against the Chersonites, who had insulted his exile and violated the laws of hospitality. Their remote situation afforded some means of defense, or at least of escape, and a grievous tax was imposed on Constantinople to supply the preparations of a fleet and army. "All are guilty, and all must perish," was the mandate of Justinian. And the bloody execution was entrusted to his favorite Stephen, who was recommended by the epithet of the Savage. Yet even the savage Stephen imperfectly accomplished the intentions of his sovereign. The slowness of his attack allowed the greater part of the inhabitants to withdraw into the country, and the minister of vengeance contented himself with reducing the youth